Jehovah God, we don't want to pray to a God who's a little higher than Buddha. We want to pray to the true and living God. We want to pray to the God of the Bible. You know, I'm reluctant on some level to speak of the death and resurrection of Jesus, because I don't want it to fall on mine or anybody else's callous heart. It's after creation, it's the profound, profound event of the universe. Please, please don't let us be apathetic. I ask you please to counter the calloused hearts that we all have on some level. Penetrate somehow. Pierce our souls. That we would somehow gain a grasp of the magnitude and our utter desperate need and dependency on what was happening. Amen. I'm sorry for last week. I was stumbling. I was not doing well. That was a rough one. So I apologize, but we're good today. Over the flu. It's good. Matthew 26 is where we're at, my plan, my God willing, my plan, my goal at this point is to talk about leading up to the crucifixion from the Last Supper until he was led to the cross. We hopefully get that far, because next week my plan, and I don't mean to be, there's nothing cutesy about it, but on Resurrection Day to speak of the death and resurrection of Jesus. So, that's the goal, that's the plan. I want to start this though. Where do I start this? I'm agreeing with Levi 100% that just because we say the right words doesn't mean that we're calling on this God. You know, I want to repeat, and men hang with me, because and don't wonder, but think of it more deeply. Last week, if I might share, Richard shared a story. He'd listened to a sermon from Mark Driscoll on spiritual warfare, and I was really blessed by the process and the direction that it took and went. And I guess I just wanted to share, I assume and would hope that you men have shared with your wives already. And I, if it's like me, it's been something that's been rather consumptive in my week in life. But I really want to put us all in the page, because it is very easy to read about this Jesus that we're going to read about and not worship this Jesus, but to worship a false God. And I don't want to do that. I would say that the predominance of this world and the predominance of this country worships a false Jesus. Just because the words are right, it just makes it that much more deceptive and destructive and wicked and hard to deal with in our culture, okay? The truth is that if you looked at the predominance of those who call themselves Christians, and we were in a different culture where they called that God something by some other name, you know? They called that God whatever. I should think of some name. They called that God Molech. They called that God anything. Okay? And they lived their lives accordingly. And they gave the verbiage to it. And they talked about him the way that they do. But they lived their lives accordingly without fear. With that God is a God that doesn't pay attention. That God is a God, if they want the blessing from, then they try to do good things. And if they want to do what they want to do, they do what they want to do. And if you looked and you said, this is your God, and this is what he looks like, and this is how he acts, and this is Jesus Christ, the God of this Bible, they would not compare. They would look very distinct. And the tragedy in our culture is that we give them both the name Jesus. And we don't acknowledge that. This Jesus is not the Jesus of the Bible. And we all struggle with that on some level. Part of it lies from our humanistic arrogance. It says we're not idolaters. We don't worship idols. That's a lie. Understand. To the degree we do not see Jesus for who he is, to the degree we, and it doesn't matter what we say with our words. We need to get past the fact that we speak correct theology. Because it doesn't matter what you say with your mouth. What you really believe is how you live your life. We say, I fear God, I serve God, and then lie, willingly lie. We do not serve and fear this God. Because this God says lying tongue, lying lips are an abomination to him. Right? The story that Richard shared was Driscoll dealing with spiritual warfare, dealing with a man who was spiritually, who was possessed by a demon, controlled by demons. And again, that looks very different than what we perceive it. But it was a man who was oppressed and controlled by a demonic. And I'll try to paraphrase it quickly. I would tend to agree that Driscoll felt like the purpose in the direction in dealing with him, and I would tend to agree, is not directly confronting demons, and speaking to demons, because it turns into a power trip pretty quickly. Demons are absolutely real. And if we do not believe in the reality of demonic, we do not believe in the God of this Bible. Okay? Period. And it should be a wake-up call for us if we do not believe in the reality of the dark spiritual forces of evil. We do not believe in the God of this Bible. Because it exists in the same spiritual realm. But he feels like, and I would tend to agree with this on some level, that the confrontation of that demon needed to speak through that person. Not directly, because it's not a power trip, it's a truth trip. It's a truth struggle, not a power struggle. Satan was defeated on the cross, and that's an important thing we understand. But this demon had controlled this person and determined this person's life. We have all different names for it in our modern psychology, but he controlled this person and dealt with him anyway. In confronting this demon, he asked the demon, what were your orders? Because you need to understand, there is a hierarchy, there's principalities and powers and dominions and authorities and rulers over regions. It's set up in a structure just like any army. Where there is ranks of authority and levels of authority within the demonic world. And he said, what were your orders from your boss, from the powers over you? And the demon said, my orders were to get the uncle of this boy to molest him. And that's what my orders were. They were to have his uncle molest him. And he said, okay, He said, what were your orders after that? And he said, my orders after that were to be the comforter to that boy who was molested. And that's true, okay? This isn't a made-up story. This isn't a figurative speech. This is a true story, okay? And this is, let me just say, incredibly common. Okay? That when somebody is abused, when somebody is oppressed, when somebody is physically or sexually or emotionally abused terribly, that oftentimes a comforter comes to them. And oftentimes we call it your guardian angel. But we give it the attribute of the power of good, the angel of light. And the demons, this is the same demon whose responsibility was to be the comforter to this child, was the same demon that was raping him. But in this child's mind, he presented that he was good. And what does that matter? What that matters is that on some level happens to so many of us. So we begin to ascribe spiritual authority, positive spiritual authority, to this demon impersonator. We begin to call that demon impersonator Jesus. We begin to ascribe to them the power and dimension and person of God. Because that is the spiritual authority that we've known that was good in our life, that was our protector, that was our defender. And tragically, most people go through their life holding on to that deceptive view of Jesus. And even though they learn from the Bible and they read from the Bible and it says, well, he's omniscient. Okay, he's omniscient. He's all-powerful. Okay, he's all-powerful. Okay, he's to be trusted. Okay, he's to be trusted. And we tend to give him to that. And yet, you know what the truth is? This demon is not trustworthy. This demon is not to be relied on, counted on. This demon is pathetic. And so what is our view of God? We say I should trust him. We say I should follow him. Oh, I know that. I know that. I trust him. I should put my faith in him. I should give my life to him. We're going, but I can't really do that. Because he's not really trustworthy. Let me just say this. If we're embittered towards God, if we're angry towards God, if we're mistrusting towards God, if we do not fear God, the God we serve is not the God of this Bible. Because you cannot respond to this God that way. And even though the name might be there, we need to move. That Jesus is not the Jesus of this Bible. And all of us, on some level, are encumbered with that idolatry. It happens in extreme oppression, extreme molestation, extreme traumatization to a child. It happens. And it's fairly universal. There's a country song. And we talked about this Thursday, but hang with me, guys. There's a country song a few years back that was a little girl hiding behind a couch as her dad was beating up her mother. And Jesus came to her. Some stranger came to her, but it was she didn't know who it was and came and comforted her, right? In the song. And I forget exactly the specific. But let me just say, then years later, she saw a picture on the wall and she goes, oh, I know that person, I met them. And it was a picture of Jesus. Let me just say that wasn't Jesus. Because he doesn't look like that picture on the wall. Did he impersonate Jesus? Absolutely. Absolutely impersonated Jesus. We have to be willing to get rid of our idolatry. If my life does not line up with what I say with my mouth, I really don't believe that about the person I claim to worship. If I'm bitter, if I'm angry, if I don't trust, if I can't surrender my life, I'm not worshiping this God, because this God will produce all that in you. Because this God is worthy to be feared. If I do not fear God, we're all guilty of it. Let me just say, it goes to as simply as this. If a father, to the degree a father misrepresents the character and nature to a child, we're not talking sexual abuse. We're not talking physical abuse. To the degree a father misrepresents the character and nature of God, they will have a false view of God. And difficult to get by. And tragically, they can come up with all the right intellectual answers. God is this, God is that, God is omnipotent, God is eternal, God is all loving, God is all caring. But the image of God has been set up by their dad who failed them. Okay? And so they worship an idol other than. And we have a difficult time transferring from that idol worship to worshiping this God. And we have to do that. Okay? And we can do that. And all of us on some level have to do that. So this Jesus that we're talking about, just because they have the same names, I don't care that you say the name Jesus Christ when you are ascribing that to this demon imitator. The Jesus Christ is either the Jesus Christ that coincides, looks just like the Jesus of this Bible. And we have to be willing to say, okay, I will quit worshiping a false God. This is who you are. And I will act accordingly. I will step out in faith according to how you've revealed yourself, not to the way the enemy revealed you to me. Not to the way the enemy lied to me and began forming that. Not to the way the world told me. Not to the way the church told me. But the way you have said you are in the Word. And I will respond according to that Jesus, not the other one I made up. I mean, there's Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Is that the Jesus of this Bible? I'm sorry, it isn't. It isn't. And there's a whole bunch of those. And just because in the church we don't add the Latter-day Saints on it, doesn't mean people are worshiping this Jesus. And that's obvious by our lives. Okay? I don't care what you say with your mouth. Your life will show me how you worship and who you worship. Period. Are you obedient to this Jesus and what he says? Or are you calloused and hard to it? And you really can't trust him and you're still bitter towards him. This Jesus, I'm going to jump ahead here a moment and read something because I think it's foundational in our understanding of who this Jesus is. Because I know myself. I'm guilty of what I'm speaking of, okay? I wasn't abused sexually or physically as a child. I thank God for that. But I didn't worship this Jesus. I know that. I had a dim view of Jesus. Still do on some level. And I'm really trying to make that right and change that and turn that around. Because the Jesus that Jesus that most of us worship, what he went through when after the Last Supper, when he went before Pilate, when he went before Herod, when he went before the high priest, that seems kind of doable and not that big a deal. And it doesn't really, we don't go, because if we read this and don't go, oh my, our view of Jesus is little and bad and wrong. And it needs to be reconciled. This Jesus, it says when he was on the cross, in verse 50 of chapter 27 of Matthew, I'll read this. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Okay? Understand, this is on the cross. This is at the moment Jesus died. Let me tell you who this man was. Let me tell you who this man was. It says, "And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, and the rocks were split, and tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many." Now let me just say, this is a passage we don't deal with very often, okay? Alright? Because what in the world did this look like? I don't know. Was it mummies? Was it zombies? Were they still in their grave clothes? It happened. This was a rock split. The veil was ripped from top to bottom. We talked about that some. This is a 12-foot tall curtain, maybe a foot wide woven. Boom, from top to bottom, completely ripped and exposed the Holy of Holies, where God's Shekinah glory no longer dwelt. No longer was. The earth trembled. These people, the graves opened and these people came back. What? I'm going to tell you. My view of this is the event that happened when Jesus died shook the world. The foundation, every aspect of the world. Satan, the enemy, he was defeated when Jesus died for the sins of mankind, and man could now be reconciled to God. It was finished at that point when he died. Satan was defeated. And the world, we're talking all aspects, the spiritual world, the atoms, the protons, all the little things went, yeah! They freaked out. The graves opened up and these people came walking into Jerusalem. Yes, that was a freak show. What that looked like? I don't know. They didn't bury him in good suits like we do. Okay? They wrapped him up like a mummy in spices, man. I mean, I don't know. But it happened. I know it happened. It says it happened. It did happen. I think the world freaked out. Every aspect of this world just went, oh, oh, when Jesus cried out with a loud voice. That is the Jesus of the Bible. This is not just a man. And we should, let me just say, when Jesus went through what happened in the garden and under the high priest and in the courtyard, we should all be going, because I'm going to tell you, they did not know who they were talking to. I mean, and that Jesus wasn't some pathetic, weak, beat-up little hippie guy. This is the man that when he cried out with a voice and gave up his spirit, the earth shook, literally. Everything in it went, whoa, what went on? People were raised from the dead and tombs opened up and they went, I mean, because the world freaked out. Satan was defeated. He knew it. And he had no idea. You know, when you look at Jesus' ministry and what was going up to there was a lot of times when what did he say to the demons? You shut up about who I am, right? Close your mouth. Don't speak anymore. What did he say to people? He knew his purpose. He knew what his ultimate purpose was. This was the very hard to read. Did Satan know the Old Testament? Yes, Satan knew the Old Testament. Was Satan able to see what was going to happen in the death of Jesus? No. Any more than just about anybody else saw it. The only way I'm convinced, there's only one way you could have known what the Old Testament was saying about what happened with Jesus. That's if you were led by the Spirit of God to interpret it. The enemy is not led by the Spirit of God. He knew the Bible well. He knew about the Messiah. He knew about setting up his rule and reign. He knew about setting up his kingship and authority on earth. He knew when that happened at some point that Satan would be cast into hell, that he would defeat him. He didn't see it coming. He thought the cross was his victory. He thought what was going down was him winning. Until friggin' earth shook and the rock split. And the power of death was overcome and people that were already dead and laying in the grave. Not just anybody. This wasn't bad zombies coming out. It says saints, holy ones that had died before coming back to life. It was people prior to Jesus that were looking forward to Jesus, that were looking forward to the Messiah. There was righteous people, man. In fact, one of the coolest things about this last couple of weeks has been looking at in trying to read the accounts in all four Gospels, because they approach it from all different angles, okay, on some level. There's the aspect of synoptic Gospels where they actually align, and then you have John. And the best I can understand it is John is an interpretation of what Jesus said. No different than what I just said. Divinely inspired? Absolutely. Inspired by the Spirit of God? Absolutely. Lying? No. Did I just lie about what Richard said on Thursday night? No, I didn't. Did I say it word for word? No, I didn't. I gave you my interpretation of what Richard said. Right? That's John. So sometimes they say, Gospels say this. The other three Gospels, John says this. You go, see, they're not right. No. John is an interpretation, as best I can tell, of what happened. Inspired by the Spirit of God. Okay? Don't get me wrong. Divinely inspired. But as I look at these four Gospels, one of this sweet, sweet thing that Gene and I were... Here we are, midnight last night, inspired to do it, looking at the connection and the heritage of righteousness and holiness in Jesus' life and in the disciples' lives. You know, Calvary Chapel, we just have this perception that, you know, the only way to God is to come from complete paganism. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's the way to God. Well, let me just say, the grace of God is great in saving us. That is not God's purpose and intention. God's purpose and intention is for godly parents to raise godly children, to raise more godly children in the fear and knowledge of God, and to raise that up. If you're the beginning of that process, be about it. It ain't supposed to end with your children, and it wasn't necessarily supposed to start that way. Coming from ungodliness. If this is a continual lineage. And when you look at Jesus and Jesus' life, it was that way. There's some really cool connections that I never made and never really even heard of on it. You know? But you look at Jesus' life. I mean, you look at John the Baptist was Jesus' cousin, right? I mean, we're talking family. God's Elizabeth and Zechariah were, God says they were holy and righteous before God. He was the high priest. Now, he obviously wasn't high priest at the moment, okay? They rotated in an annual basis, they rotated out when it was their turn to do it. He was high priest, and he was a holy and righteous man. That was his aunt and uncle, Jesus. John was like a second cousin. You look at it at the cross. And Jesus' mother, Mary's sister, was there. Well, you know what it looks like she is? She's the wife of Zebedee. Who was Zebedee? He was the father of James and John. Right? The sons of thunder. You mean they were Jesus' cousins? Yeah. We're Jesus' cousins. I mean, absolutely. I'm pretty confident, absolutely. When you look, it says that's what it says. Andrew brought Peter. Okay? They were brothers in this deal. You know, there's a real good chance that they were related to Jesus by the names that are given. Now understand something that is very, very clear. That is a correct way and a right way, but understand something, that the spiritual bond that God intends for us to have is stronger than any blood ties. Period. Okay? There's not outside the blood or outside the family. But God intends for righteousness to beget righteousness. God does not intend for ungodly parents and somebody to be called by Him and come in with complete ungodly parents and begin to pursue God with all their heart, and then their children become ungodly. Something's failed there. That's not the process that's supposed to happen. All of us on some level, Gene and I ourselves, man, we need to stop that process and start the process of the fear and knowledge of God in our lives, in our children, in our grandchildren. And that's the right way to do it. The nation Israel, so with John, there's a good chance that John and James and John, there's a good chance that John was part of his father's fishing business. He had a good fishing business that was going on in the Sea of Galilee, and they brought fish and sold them in Jerusalem. Tradition says on some level that he had a place in Jerusalem. You know, he was probably known to the high priest. And when it says that Peter was there with the high priest at the trial when it was happening, John was, and it says the one who was well known to the high priest was also there along with Jesus. It doesn't say that in the other three Gospels. In John, it says he was there. And actually, he was known to the high priest, and he went in and went to the door, and the person keeping the door and said, "No, Peter, you can come in," because he had the authority to do that. Well, if you look at the connection with the high priest and Elizabeth and Zechariah, who was a high priest, and you look at that these are his family, they were known to the high priest. Even though the high priest was a stinking mess, man, Caiaphas was not a good dude. Completely deceived. Jesus, this is a profound event. All of us have seen, I don't want to have this be a digress, but all of us on some level have seen the contemporary, I don't know what we call them, you know, action movies. And there's Relentless, there's the guy who, he doesn't have superpowers, he's not, but he's just this really, really, really good guy with a gun, guy with a fight, guy with a judo or whatever he's got, you know, doing it. I mean, the guy's, and so often, I mean, this is a theme throughout so many movies, you know, finally the bad guys have him tied up and have him captured and have him, you know, they've found kryptonite or something, you know, and they've got him wrapped up and tied in the chair, you know, and they're going to torture him and kill him, and, you know, the worst of all bad guys is there, you know. I mean, it's a fairly common theme, and he's, you know, I see, finally, you know, I'm going to kill you, and all right, you guys, get it done. He walks out of the room, and what happens? What happens, man? He kicks their butt, right? I mean, he just, you know, it's not real, but he kicks their butt, okay? Out of the chair, tied up, man. They're all dead. There's six of them laying on the ground dead, and he's off to go save the girl. Whatever, right? Because that's the way it is. They didn't realize, when we're all watching the movie going, they don't know who they have tied up there, do they? I mean, you know, they don't know. They don't realize, you know, this guy's going to get her done. You know, we know. The movie ain't over yet. He's still got to be he's going to get it done right here. They did not know who they had, that they were spitting on, punching in the face, beating, scourging.
Jesus, when he spoke, gave up his life personally, the earth shook. The inner workings, the life and death was rocked to its core when he spoke. And they were slapping. I'm going to tell you, there's going to come a day when those people are going to be in utter panic. Probably already are. I mocked him. I spit in his face. I slapped him. I punched the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, God. The truth is, all of us do. All of us have with our lives. And we should be in fear. All of us have said, nope, screw you. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to revere you. But what went on here, again, I mean, and Peter, did they understand it? Did the disciples understand it? Did the people around understand it? No. They were foolish and ignorant and didn't understand. Hi, Kelsey. And they didn't understand what they were doing. I realize I spent a bunch of time doing a setup here. I do not want to read this about what happened and just be hard-hearted about it, okay? This is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords willingly submitting and surrendering his life to abuse, to submission. And again, if the response isn't, oh my gosh, you know what you're doing, man, let's run for cover. Because this is God you were speaking to. In Matthew 26. Verse 31. This is after a supper. Then Jesus said to them, I don't know if they were on their way or if they were still there for a little bit longer. We just spent the last couple of weeks talking about the discourse in John, right? That happened at this time. The discourse in John happened after supper. While they were there, my assumption was they were still in the upper room. I'm not sure if they were walking at this time. It doesn't really matter. Then Jesus said to them, you will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. But Peter answered and said to him, even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Jesus said to him, truly I say to you, that this very night before a cock crows. You will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. All the disciples said the same thing too. I'm going to throw in a couple of additions that come from the other Gospels, okay? And this one is Luke 22, verse 35. I'll just read it to you because there's actually a bunch of fullness that happens from the other ones. Some of them have some similar stuff, but this is Luke. Okay. And so this is, it says, let me just read it. It says that Satan had asked for permission and been granted permission to thrash Peter. Okay? That's a big deal. Okay? Why? Because God hated him? No. Because Jesus hated him? No. Jesus knew it. He told Satan. Satan has asked permission and has been granted for him to pound on you. Okay? For the greater good. Does that happen? That happens. We get attacked. We're going to get beat up. There's still a purpose. We still, through that, the purpose is, and the reason for that is to serve God. And to serve God more full. Then, but they said they would not, to deny him. Excuse me. In verse 35 there of Luke 22, there's another section that it says that he adds to the same thing. And he said to them, because this is important to understand before they get to the garden, okay? And it's something that, again, isn't talked about much. But he said to them, when I sent you out before, Jesus says, without purse or without bag or without sandals, remember when he sent them out to do mission work, basically, to go out and spread the gospel earlier on in the ministry? And he says, don't take sandals, don't take a tunic, don't take purse isn't a purse, okay? Guys were allowed to carry a purse at the time. Levi? A satchel. Okay, knapsack. Purse is the word, but purse just wasn't a woman's thing, you know. It's like a bag with a thing that goes over your shoulder, okay? And he says, I sent you out without that. Did you lack anything? And they said, no, nothing. And he said to them, but now, let him who has a purse take it along. This is Jesus preparing them prior to going. He says, likewise also a bag. And let him who has no sword sell his robe and buy one. I think that's my justification for buying guns, isn't it? No. Yeah. For I tell you that this which is written must be fulfilled in me, and he was classed among criminals, and that which refers to me has its fulfillment. And they said, Lord, look, here are two swords. And he said to them, it's enough. So, okay, this is important, because in a minute here, we're going to see them responding to that, right? Would seemingly be right if they would respond to it. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And he took with him Peter and two of the sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and distressed. Then they said to them, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with me. And he went a little beyond them and he fell on his face and he prayed saying, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Not I, not my will, but your will. And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, so, you men could not keep watch with me for 1 hour? This has always been troubling to me. Has it been troubling anybody else? Seems like Jesus is getting his feelings hurt, you know? You know? Right? I mean, and he's being a little sarcastic. You know, it seems like Jesus being a little grumpy, you know, kind of in the deal. So, you men could not keep watch with me for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. He went away a second time and prayed, saying, my Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, thy will be done. And he came back and he found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy. And he left them again, and he went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Arise, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand. I don't know, has anybody else struggled with that coming up? This seems like Jesus' response is kind of short and curt and, what's the matter with you? I mean, by the way, you know, it was the middle of the night and they just ate Passover dinner and kind of tuckered, you know? I mean, what's up? You know, why are you being... There's something I think that's very important to understand, and it's a subtle thing and a small thing. No, it's really not. But it's an explanation of why and what Jesus was talking about. What's he talking about, the temptation? Be watchful and pray, lest the temptation overcome you. Does anybody know what that means? What is the temptation that he's talking about? In Luke chapter 22, he's speaking about the same time. Luke is reiterating it in chapter 40, in verse 40, he says, and when he arrived at that place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray, saying, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. In verse 45, he says, And when he arose from prayer, he came to his disciples and found them sleeping from sorrow. Sleeping from sorrow. What's the inclination when you get depressed? You can sleep, huh? To go curl up in your bed would be the end of it, right? That's how you feel when you're depressed, when you're struggling with depression, right? It's overwhelming. You get tired. Is this how you act when you're depressed? No. When you're depressed, and it overwhelms you with sorrow, right? They were struggling with depression. And let me just say, this is a very, Jesus, why did Jesus reprove him? Because he says, do not be controlled by your feelings. Watch and pray, lest you be tempted. Lest you be pounded by temptation. When we are struggling with depression, when we are struggling with sorrow and grief are something we should experience, no. But when we are struggling with temptation, we are not to allow our feelings to control us. Because we will be beat up in temptation. The enemy will use that. How does Jesus say respond to that? Be watchful and pray. Don't be overcome with your feelings. Because they were overcome with their feelings. They were overcome with the way they felt. And it trashed them. They responded when the guys came up in a few minutes here. They took off running and fearful. They denied Jesus. Why? Because they were controlled by their feelings. They're controlled by their fear, by their sorrow, by their depression. And Jesus is saying, when you're struggling here, I know you're struggling with depression here because I've told you I'm going to be killed. And they're all going, what is happening, man? I mean, we've been at this for 3 years and this is going bad quickly. What is happening? And they were depressed. And Jesus said, do not let your depression, again, I mean, think about it. If it was, I don't want to make light of it, you know, but if it was opening day next day and they were excited about doing it, they don't have a problem staying awake, right? You know, they're wound up if they're feeling like this is a good thing happening. Okay? Even if you're tired, you're up if something's got you excited. But they weren't. They were depressed. And Jesus said, you guys, be careful. You're being controlled by your emotions. Pray. Be watchful and pray. Let's keep going here. In verse 47. And while they were speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Another one of the things that says that they were given a cohort. They were given probably a Roman cohort with 600 Roman soldiers. Bunch of dudes. And bad dudes. Here they are to come to Jesus. They were not going to allow the mob to have victory here. They came marching in power. And Satan, and he's very clearly to say, you know, this is your hour. This is your time that I'm giving you. And you are empowered by the forces of darkness here. Okay? Is what he says. And it's important. Now, look at the boys. The boys are with him again. He just gave them instructions on sell your tunic, get a sword, do that. Okay? They came up with a great multitude with swords and clubs, the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now, he who was betraying them, gave them a sign, saying, whoever I shall kiss, he is the one, seize him. And immediately he came to Jesus and says, hail, Rabbi, and kissed him. And Jesus said, and this is the thing of, you know, which tempers, again, when we feel like, gosh, you responded kind of harshly to your disciples. I mean, you know, you seem like you're being sarcastic and cynical and saying, grow up something, you know. I guess I shouldn't say that, probably recorded, but the boys know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, come on. You know, it would seem like that's what he was saying. That wasn't his heart, because look at his heart. His heart is compassionate and kind and caring towards Judas who betrays him. What, how does he address him? Friend. Friend. Do what you have come for. Then they came and laid hands on Jesus. Was Jesus overcome and overruled and his actions determined by his feeling? No, because he'd been watchful and prayed. Jesus, of all people, was the feelings were overwhelming. What he was looking forward to in the garden, he knew the sins of the world were going to be put on him. And his dad, who he'd never had broken fellowship, was going to reject him and turn away from him. He was going to be beaten and scourged and tortured. Tortured physically. I don't think that was his main overwhelming feeling. I think it was that he was going to take the sins of the world on himself. All the sins of the world. The heavy weight. He hadn't known sin. He hadn't known the guilt and shame of sin. He hadn't known the burden of sin. He hadn't known the heaviness of sin. He hadn't known the rejection of his Father, ever. And he was just broken by it and could have easily responded with his feelings. He didn't. He responded because he'd been watchful in praying. He responded by the leadership and submission to God. He was protected. Okay? Friend, do what you have come to. Then he came, they laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Yeah, let's get her done. Right? I mean, he told him to do it. Was Peter doing something wrong? You know, Peter was controlled by his feelings because he just let himself be controlled by his feelings instead of being watchful and praying. And he was controlled by his feelings. Was it an understandable response? Yeah, Jesus just said, now we're going to have swords, man. And let me just say what, tell you what. Peter was a bad dude, man. I mean that in a good way. There was 600 Roman soldiers there. And he takes his sword out and says, let's go. I mean, he was definitely the real deal, but again, overcome by his feeling, because the minute he's going to turn tail and run. He cut off his ear. John says it was Peter. We don't know. It doesn't say this one, but the Gospel of John says it was Peter who did that. And it says the other ones were ready too. And it says in another one of the Gospels, it says, the rest of them asked, do we draw our swords, Jesus? Is this it, man? Are we going to get it done here? Nope. That's not what you're going to do. Jesus said to him, put your sword back in its place. For all those who take the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you not think that I came, that I could, this is a wild one. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? That's more than 72,000 angels. Okay? How then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen this way? Because Jesus said, this is the scriptures. He knew the scriptures. This is had to happen. And it had, because it was predicted in the scriptures. Could you have read it and seen it? I doubt it without inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Can we read it Monday morning? We can. It's there. At that time, Jesus said to the multitudes, have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were a robber? Every day I used to sit in the temple teaching and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled. Then all the disciples left and fled. I'm sure when he whacked the ear off, it produced a response. Okay? There was 600 Roman soldiers there, and I'm sure they came to attention, at night or not. When the first, because that little, pardon me, I want to say whiny servant boy, for some reason I think he's the servant of a corrupt Caiaphas, who's a priest doing it, so you have to excuse me. I'm sure he screamed like a little girl when they cut his ear off. Pardon me, women. They shouldn't say. Screamed like a little boy, okay, better? He screamed, okay? And when that scream in the middle of the night went out, I'm sure the soldiers came to high alert. What's this look like? And all of a sudden now, these disciples who hadn't been watching and praying were controlled by their emotion went, oh my. Jesus said, we're not to fight. Let's go. Let's get out of here. Then the disciples left him and fled. And those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter also followed him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus in order that they might put him to death. This is God. This is God sitting there. And they didn't find it, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward. It says in another gospel, their stories didn't match. You know, they were looking for a way they could kill him, but they, you know, put him to death. And he said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. Yeah, Jesus kind of said that, didn't he? And the high priest stood up and said, do you make no answer? What is this that these men are testifying against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. I want to stop there a minute and say that again, okay? They're accusing him. They're beating him. It says in other accounts they were slapping him in the face. They blindfolded him. They were spitting at him in the face and punching him in the face and saying, okay, you're a prophet. Tell us which one you are. Tell us who did it. Tell us the guy who did it. And Jesus was silent. And he didn't answer him. And they were going through this process. And he turns around and says, you know what? Next time you see me, I will be sitting at the right hand of the power of God. And you're going to pee your pants. I mean, it was Jesus saying, yeah, gee, boys, I have no idea what you're doing here. He wasn't defending himself. He wasn't making, there's another statement in John. In John it says, when Judas came up to him, okay? Remember, we talked about it at the cross, his voice spoke. When Judas came up to him, it says, and he says, okay, where is Jesus of Nazareth? Okay? And Jesus said, I am he. And it says they all fell down. All the Roman soldiers, the high priest, all fell down. Hey, now, I don't know how you keep up this gig, you know? I mean, Jesus spoke, and they all fell down. And they obviously got back up. Said, where is he? And he says, I'm he. I mean, this is God. This is a different Jesus than most of us worship. This is God incarnate. The submission that he did for us individually. The Jesus that most of us worship, this is no big deal for him to get accused falsely and get beat up and stuck on a cross and die for our sins. Doesn't really shake us. It's just something we try to hold on to. Okay, theologically, that's what happened. Okay, why did it happen? Why did he do that? Why did Jesus need to die for our sin? Oh, this is God giving up his authority for me, for you, for us, to redeem the creation to God. Because this is necessary. It was the only way it could happen to redeem us to him. He says, Jesus said, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter, next time, you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He's blaspheming. What further need do we have of witness? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered and said, "He's deserving of death." Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is the one who hit you?" Now Peter was sitting outside the courtyard, and a certain servant girl came to him and said, "You too were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you're talking about." I think the boy was a little run by his emotions. And when he had come out, when he'd gone out to the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again he denied it with an oath, saying, "I do not know the man." And a little further later, the bystander came up and said to Peter, "Surely you too are one of them, for the way you talk gives you away." Because they talk different in Galilee with a different accent. Then Peter began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man." And immediately the cock crowed. And Peter remembered the word which Jesus had said, "Before a crow cocks, you will deny me three times." And he went out and he wept bitterly. It says in another one of the deals that this girl that accused him was a servant girl, was a relative of the high priest's servant, Malchus, who Peter had cut his ear off. She was pissed. And they were there, says the relative, watching, and said, and saw Peter do this. Because of his emotions, he went there, cut the ear off, and she accused him. And she probably went, "Hey, this guy was there." And she starts telling the friends, and they all came and said, "Accuse him." Peter ran out. Now when morning had come, all the chief priests and the elders and the people took counsel, again all night, took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and they led him away and they delivered him to Pilate the governor. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned to the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. That's an interesting thing that I've contemplated for the last several months, and I think that, well, I don't have an answer to it yet. When he saw that he was condemned, he felt remorse. I think he had a different outcome in thinking of it. You know, did he do something radical in betraying Jesus? Yeah. But it's not what he thought it was going to look like, somehow. There was something about it that was different. He was looking forward to the kingdom, and Jesus wasn't getting there, and he wasn't getting that done. And I'm not sure what he had in mind, but it wasn't this. And saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What's that to us? See to that yourself." Remember, they'd given him 30 pieces of silver to lead him to the Garden of Gethsemane, because this was a regular place that Jesus went and hung out. He threw the pieces of silver into the sanctuary and departed. And he went away and hanged himself. And the chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, "It's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood." And they counseled together, and with that money they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet, again, an Old Testament prophecy again, was fulfilled, saying, "And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." Now Jesus stood before the governor questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he said, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he made no answer. He said he was king of the Jews. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" And he did not answer with him with regard to even a single charge, so that the governor was quite amazed. It was God being silent. There's a side of it
if Jesus would have spoke out with extreme emotion or with anger, might not have gone well. Remember? He spoke out with a loud voice at the end of his age when he let up his thing and the stones cracked, the earth cracked, the earth shook. Jesus was silent, and I believe he was silent. He did not defend himself. Now at the feast, it says during the same time that Herod was in town. Another one of the Gospels, okay? Herod was the governor of Galilee, right? What had Herod done? This is a different Herod, okay, than the Herod that killed the babies that was there with Jesus' birth, right? Remember, Satan's known about the Messiah and trying to get it done since he was born, right? He was there. He was there at the birth of Jesus. He tried to kill him by having Herod kill the babies, right? That was Satan. He's been after him, trying to get it done. But this is another Herod who was governor of the northern region doing that. And what had Herod done? Herod, who'd Herod beheaded? John the Baptist, right? He'd beheaded John the Baptist earlier on. He hadn't met Jesus. It says in the other gospel that he was really glad and he was looking forward to this. He happened to be there for the festival. I mean, again, this is a 100,000, town of 100,000 go. This is like the World Fair going on, only it was an annual ritual. But there was, you know, maybe 2.5 million people in Jerusalem, and Herod was there for the deal. It says that Herod and Pilate, who was the governor of Jerusalem, weren't buddies. They had animosity, enmity between them, it said. But Herod, Pilate going, I don't know what to do with this guy. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's from your, are you from Galilee? Okay, Herod's here in town. Let him judge you. And he sent him to Herod. And Herod goes, he was kind of excited to meet him because he heard about the miracles and seen what he'd done. And he hadn't met Jesus doing it. His heart had hardened though, okay? Because remember about John, he didn't want to kill John. Okay? It said that he was intrigued. He talked to John. John was speaking to him and he was listening to what he said. But the mother was very jealous, right? The stepmother. Actually his brother's wife who he'd stole, okay? And basically got her daughter to seduce him in whatever way. And so that he said, I'll give you whatever, up to half my kingdom. And she said, I want John's head on a platter. And they cut John's head off. And it said he was grieved. Obviously his heart had hardened since then. Because although he was very intrigued and wanted to meet Jesus, it says that when Jesus wouldn't, he kept questioning him and questioning him and questioning him. It said Jesus wouldn't answer his questions. I don't know if he got mad at that point or did what. But it says, so he took his guard that was with him, because he brought his Roman soldiers with him from down from Galilee. He took him and they began to beat him and mock him. And they dressed him glamorously, it said, dressed him like a king, and these guys put a crown of thorns on his head. And then they sent him back to Pilate in a mocking way. Pilate sent him to him and said, judge this guy. He's from your place, man. I'm going to have a riot on my hands here. There's 2.5 million people. I don't want this wreck here. This guy's innocent as far as I can tell. You tell me what he's done wrong. He's been hanging out in your place for 3 years. I don't know him. You know, I don't know what's going on with this guy. And it says that after this, they became good friends. A couple of wicked guys, Herod and Pilate, you know. Because he sent him to Herod, and Herod mocked him and goes, he claims to be the king of the Jews. Here, what are you going to deal with that? And I guess Pilate must have got a good laugh at it, because after that they became friends in doing it. So this is all on the same day, remember, through the night and through the morning, and they're sending him back and forth, and every one of them takes their turn to beat him and to mock him. When therefore they had gathered, they were gathered together, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ? For he knew that because of envy they had delivered him up. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife said to him, have nothing to do with this righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death.
But the governor answered and said to them, "Which two do you want me to release to you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said, "What shall I then I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" And they said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they kept shouting all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." And Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting. He took water, and he washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourself." Well, he wasn't quite innocent, because he's going to condemn him to death. Okay? Might appease his conscience for a minute. And all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Oh my. Then he released Barabbas for them, but Jesus he scourged and delivered over to be crucified. Probably 40 lashings, or 39. You know, Jesus was probably, by the time they got done with this, Jesus was probably already halfway to death. They beat him so bad, and so relentlessly and continuously. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole Roman cohort together around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And after weaving a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. And they knelt down before him and mocked him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spat on him and they took the reed and began to beat him on the head. And after they had mocked him, they took his robe off and they put his garments on and they led him away to crucify him. I challenge you guys this week to think about this. To think about God becoming flesh and giving up all right, all authority, all dominion. I mean, I can't imagine that. I mean, it's a really good thing it wasn't me. Because I'd have called those 72,000 angels down. I mean, Jesus did it because he loved us. Jesus laid his life down because he loved us. Jesus laid his life down because he was obedient to the Father. Absolutely obedient to the Father. If this history of what Jesus did and what happened there does not make us stand back with wide eyes and go, "Oh my gosh, they have no idea who they're treating this way and what they're doing." I mean, there will come a day when they will know. There will come a day when we will all know. There will come a day when we will see Jesus with all the power of God. It says in Revelation that he will ride in on a giant white war horse with blood and sword, kicking ass and taking numbers, man. Understand that the importance of this. Jesus defeated Satan. Has been the prince of the power of this world since he deceived Adam and Eve in the garden. He's the ruler of this world. He's the authority of this world. We have no ability to come out from that authority except for Jesus defeated him. I mean, it's everything. This act is everything. And as he heads towards the cross here, as he goes, I mean, the things that happened that day, I mean, the earth got dark from noon till 3. The earth went dark when Jesus was on the cross. This isn't just the luck of a solar eclipse, okay? The earth went dark. I mean, this is huge. And Satan thought he was having victory. It is a profound,
profound thing that is the most important event in our lives on a personal level, or we're in desperate trouble. And I would challenge you all to reevaluate the telling of the story. You know? I was troubled this week, thinking the whole week about, you know, the name of this building, this church, is this meeting is called Calvary Chapel, right? You know what Calvary means? The skull. That's what it means. The place of the skull. That's not a very good name. We're the Chapel of the Skull? I don't know why we would want to call ourselves. We've come up with all these funky deals. I mean, you know, we have this cutesy little three crosses that sit there, right? And aren't these, isn't this a sign of who we are and what we are? What do the two robbers' crosses have to do with anything? Nothing! It isn't about a post that he was crucified on. It was about the King of Kings and Lord of Lords giving up his life for us. And yeah, maybe we ought to be the Chapel of the Skull. I mean, this is a radical, dreadful thing that happened and necessary. Let's pray. Jesus, have mercy on us. Jesus, I thank you for being quiet in our lives like you were quiet. Because you knew the necessity of going through with the crucifixion and resurrection, with dying for our sins in our place. That had to happen, and you were not going to let your emotions get in the way of that. Otherwise, you would have spoken and this world would have rocked. I thank you. I thank you that you do the same in our lives. I thank you for your patience in our disrespect. I thank you for patience in our prayers. But God, I ask you to lay on all of us that the burden is on us to not remain there. That we need to begin worshiping and being obedient to the God of this, that you have revealed in your word, that is not just in the books and not in this intellectual and not just theological, but he has revealed in the truth of the Holy Spirit in this world. And the Holy Spirit longs to reveal and magnify you, Jesus. And we can know that, and there is no excuse for us to remain idolaters. We can serve the true and living God. And I thank you for that. I thank you that you went away. I thank you that you were willing to send your Spirit to rock each one of our worlds, to soften each one of our hard hearts, to shine the light in the dark places, and I thank you for that. God, I ask that you would cause this world, God, please, cause this, our week, this week, all of us, to be filled with thoughts of what is going on, what happened, what is this day that we're looking forward. It is not representative of a goddess Astar. It is the profound intervention, you killing Jesus in our place so that you could restore us to you. And the whole creation longed for that, and the whole creation is dependent on that. There is nothing of greater importance. God, cause us to realize, please, what this day we set aside to honor is. The death and resurrection of Jesus. Cause us to not hang this little imitator, deceptive, demonic idol of Jesus that we hold and live our lives by
on that cross, but cause us to realize that we need to understand who was on that cross. Thank you for your mercy. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your gentleness. Thank you that in spite of our wretchedness, just like Judas, you say, friend. Amen. Need some organ music.